Hey, convince the Zoom gun to disappear again.
That's why I need to accept that it's filming.
What are you looking for?
Outline view. I want to look. Switch windows. Yeah, okay, could do it like this.
But now it's not prepared to
It's not.
Zoom, so the recording will not work. As soon as we do that, we come back to where we were a moment ago.
Okay. So okay. I have basically only titles at the top, so it doesn't matter too much. Yeah.
Let's go. See if we
Rather
can.
at the top, less at the bottom.
Very good.
Internet, I don't know what
That's
this means.
to stop the screen sharing. There we go.
Okay. That's right. Okay.
Thanks for reconvening here. Our next speaker will be Maurice Pascal Reiter from Edinburgh, and he will report on a radiothyroid ion capture instrument. Please, Maurice.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks for the organizers for having me here. So we talk about the Rafiki instrument, and those of you who remember the Lion King, of course, you see our proud mascot over there who carries the radium fluoride on his walking stick. So throughout this.
This one.
No, not again. Now it works. So I think I don't need to convince anybody in the room that molecules are very interesting laboratories, interesting probes to study our fundamental forces, our understanding of the of physics, such as, for example, looking for the electric dipole moment. And you've also seen throughout this workshop already that molecules, some of the most stringent tests, for example, on the electric dipole moment of the electron, actually come from molecules such as thorium oxide, hafnium fluoride, ytterbium fluoride. So I don't need to convince you about this. You're already here. Good. And then what do we want for the next really good EDM measurement? And this was already addressed yesterday in the talk. Ideally, we want isotopes of large set. We want something that's easy to polarize. And we want molecules or atoms, perhaps, also that are in the correct or in a suitable level configuration. And ideally, we want to be able to cool those to ultra cool temperatures. And then also, if we want to step one step further, we want to be able to have a molecule where we have many isotopes in one of the two species. And then we can look at different configurations. We can think about having an open shell molecule with a closed shell nucleus, a closed shell molecule with an open shell nucleus of spin one half, an open shell molecule with an open shell nucleus, and an open shell molecule with an open shell nucleus of very large spins. Hopefully, I don't have any of those twice in there. So if we now use different combinations, we want to replace one of our nuclei, probably the heavy one, the high Z one, with different isotopes. So making the same molecule, but replacing one of the partner species. So as soon as we do this, we actually go from using stable molecules to using radioactive molecules. And meaning we need to now look at radioactive isotopes, which now comes at the challenge that those now don't exist on our Earth naturally. And also we now don't can source the sample sort of a grams of a certain molecule. We now really work with sub nanograms, sort of with 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 particles per second. So I'm a nuclear physicist, and in nuclear physics, we roughly have two types of facilities that we use to produce now these radioactive isotopes. The first one is sort of an isotype facility, but here we take a very intense light particle beam, typically protons, neutrons, photons, or something light. We put this on a high Z target material, for example, uranium. We do nuclear reactions inside our block of uranium. This is closely coupled to an ion source. And then these neutral particles will diffuse out of the target to an ion source. They get ionized. We can mass separate them at rather low kinetic energy, sort of 30 to 60 kilo electron volt kinetic energy. So low energy beams. In term compared to, let's say, particle physics energies. And then we can have really a pure beam with a very high brilliance from these isotope facilities. So the strength really is you get decent intensities from these facilities. You have really high quality secondary beams, small form size, very high intensity. However, sadly, because you are now limited by unwanted or uncontrollable chemistry inside this production target. Actually, some elements don't come out of this. And also, throughout your experiment, the properties of your production target may change between the beginning and the end of your experiment. An example may be, for example, if we run experiments at the facility in Canada, and we're using a high-power tantalum target, and we irradiate this tantalum target for 6 weeks, then actually every second atom of tantalum in our production target has undergone a nuclear reaction. That means after 6 weeks, every second tantalum is no longer tantalum, but has changed into some other element or has been extracted. That means these targets then change. You get lots of chemistry that you don't want, also some chemistry that is beneficial. And then some elements just never make it out of your production target. An example, maybe, oxygen isotopes that really like to form uranium oxide inside your production target, and then they just stay in there. They don't diffuse out. You cannot study those isotopes. So the opposite facility are so-called in-flight facilities, and these ones do the same nuclear reactions, but in the other direction. So here we take a heavy particle beam, accelerate it to, let's say, 60% the speed of light, and then smash it on a thin production target, beryllium, carbon, hydrogen, to produce the very same radioactive isotopes. We then use large-scale separators. So for example, here, a fragment separator. This device here would be between 70 to 100 meters long. So very large dipole magnets to filter out the good ions from the bad ions. So if you're interested in experiments with relativistic ions, this is a really great facility because you can produce all elements, all isotopes. But the problem if you want to do precision experiments and your isotopes fly with about 100 MeV per U kinetic energy, it's really hard to trap them in any sort of ion trap or optical trap. So the advantage is really you get all elements, but therefore the beam properties are typically much worse. For example, at GSI, the beam size is not a millimeter as here, for example, at an ISOL facility, but the focal point is closer to, let's say, 20 by 10 centimeters. So your beam spot is much, much larger, and you typically have slightly lower intensities. Now, but these are the two types of facilities we have to produce radioactive isotopes. And over the last years, radium fluoride has been identified as one possible candidate to work with radioactive isotopes. It has a rather simple electronic structure. It's laser coolable. And in principle, just with a few isotopes, one can already cover many of the previously discussed classes. Has a quite strong internal electric field, a strong shift moment. So that looks really, really promising. And there are many other radioactive molecules out there, such as actinium, actinium-OH, palladium, protactinium. So there's a whole zoo of different molecules, often containing actinides, but actually we know very little about the chemistry of these actinide molecules. Some of them we don't even know if they exist, or others we have seen and have just discarded or thrown away from our data set. So radium fluoride was very well studied at the CRISP beamline at Isolde. I think we hear about this more, I think, tomorrow on Thursday. Thursday, yeah. So I'll be very quick on this. So this was as an ISOL facility. Radium fluoride was produced by allowing CF4 gas into this production target, uranium production target. You have neutral reactions of radium with CF4, producing radium fluoride as a 1+ ion, then extracted, was mass separated, and then the laser spectroscopy was done. And more recently, they've also done spectroscopy of the vibrational and rotational spectra. So this is a really cool experiment, and this works really well. However, if you have worked at an online facility, know that online experiments also come at have some disadvantage. They come at a cost. One maybe the most obvious one, maybe availability of facility time. So running, for example, a facility in Canada at Triumph for about an hour is around $30,000 per hour. GSI in Germany may be around 40 or 50,000 pounds per hour, sorry, dollars per hour. So that means there's actually a massive invest into our research if we now apply for a week, 2 weeks. So if we now want to do an EEDM measurement using, for example, radium fluoride, one can pick your estimates. This may be between, let's say, 6 months to a year of continuous tuning time and then a precision experiment. So you can see that actually this is not really affordable to actually apply for 12 months of beam time at one of those radioactive beam facilities. And then there are, of course, other limitations in terms of beam scheduling. When you can do your experiment, you typically build up radioactive material in your experiment, meaning if something breaks, perhaps you cannot even touch your ion trap for the next 12 months until you can fix it. And of course, these environments are inherently noisy. There are lots of electric and magnetic fields that are constantly ramped up and down. There are large blocks of concrete moved through the facility, or a haul crane is moving back and forth. That's a large chunk of iron that changes your experiments. And of course, there are radiation fields. So it would be really nice if we could do similar experiments now at home at our local university labs, being somewhere decentralized from these large-scale radioactive beam facilities. So how can we now produce radium fluoride? Or let's start by how could we produce radium? And I'll focus on these few example cases. So here, 222 radium to 225 radium, they have half-lives between 30 seconds to 15 days. So in that sense, these would be nice radium isotopes with which one could actually get very long coherence times, very long trapping times. And all of those can actually very elegantly produced from the decay of thorium. And you see here, 226 thorium, 30 minutes, half-life, 227 thorium, 18 days, 228, 2 years, 229, 8,000 years. That means if you have a sample of these isotopes, you actually constantly have produced these radium isotopes. Yeah, in that sense, a generator, similar as it's done with medical isotopes, where you produce those, you produce a precursor ion, you leave this as a sample, you have your generator build up a certain amount of material, you take it out, and you let it build up again. Now, in terms of the thorium isotopes, we can even do a sidestep. If we have, this is only 30 minutes, that means this isotope could only be usable for, let's say, 2 or 4 half-lives, but we can actually produce 230 uranium as a half-life of 20 days, and then we could actually work with this sample for about, let's say, 100 days. So for the next 100 days, you have a rather stable, and by stable, I mean predictable intensity of your radium ions. And similar, you could expand the usable time for the 227 thorium by producing 227 actinium, which has 21 years. And then for the next 40 years, you have a very stable source to produce 223 radium for your experiment. So now one problem of this is that all these radium isotopes are actually produced via alpha decay. And if you remember from your second year physics lecture, alpha decay is a two-body decay, means via energy and momentum conservation. The energy of this decay is shared between the two particles, meaning the alpha particle will get about 5 to 7 MeV kinetic energy, and the radium will get about 60 to 100 keV kinetic energy. That means also from this decay now, the radium nucleus are actually produced at a very high kinetic energy. So we need now a structure to actually stop them and then turn them into a low energy ion beam. And here we can piggyback on work that has been done at these in-flight facilities. So if you want to do low energy experiments at an in-flight facility, they commonly take their radioactive beam and they put it in one of those stopping cell devices. So these are typically sort of a cubic meter devices. They're filled with ultra pure helium gas. And then you have your incoming ion beam. It collides with the helium gas. It stops inside your stopping cell. Then you can use a combination of electric fields, DC and RF fields, to transport them towards some exit site. Here you typically have some sort of RF structure that creates a pseudopotential wall that ions cannot hit the surface. Then you superimpose a DC gradient to transport them to an exit hole. And then here you can flush them out of the gas flow. So these devices typically operate at about 100 to 300 millibar helium gas. And as I said, these are typically large devices. Here's two stopping cells operated at GSI. This is the one at the fragment separator, it's about 1 meter long. That's the one at the ship trap, about 30 centimeters long. There are also larger versions here operated in the US, which has a large cyclotron magnet around it to extend the flight path. And also some gas cells are directly optimized to really do neutral extraction, whether you already neutralize your particle and then just extract the neutral particle, the neutral just via gas flow. So the advantage for us is now these devices are sort of somewhat established technology, but they are used to stop MeV beams. Now our radium is only sort of 100 keV, so we don't need to build a cubic meter stopping cell, but actually a 10 centimeter device is already sufficient for us to harvest all the radium from the decay of thorium. Yeah.
I'm sorry, keep up with you. What's the nature of the source? Like, let's say you have some thorium 29.
Yeah.
Is it like a very thin film, or is it a substrate? And what, you know, why is it that the recoil really matters, given that it's in probably in some material?
So typically we just take a small coin of tantalum and we just position thorium on top of it. either by sending an ion beam on top of it, or more commonly, if it is long-lived thoriums, they're produced at reactors, and they get diluted in some solution. You just put a drop of some liquid with thorium on your coin, you let the liquid dilute away or diffuse away, and now you have thorium weakly bound on your surface. So it means the thorium sits there, and every time it decays, half the time, let's say the alpha particle goes into the sort of away from your surface. At that point, the radium gets pushed deeper into the structure, and these ones are basically lost. And the other time, if the alpha particle goes into the surface, now the radium gets so much kinetic energy that it can leave the surface, and then it will just fly away from the surface. So if you are in vacuum, then your thorium, your radium has 60 keV energy, so it just go across your vacuum chamber until it hits the next side of your chamber, and then it sits there, but you don't have access to it. So you now want to stop the radium inside a controllable gas volume. And then helium is really nice, because actually the radium survived the stopping process as a combination of 1+, 2+, and 3+ ions. And now you have low energy ions with EV energy, so you can really use very small electric fields to actually control them, to move them over to the next structure. And in principle, this scheme can also be applied to everything that does an alpha decay. So I had a quick look on the nuclear chart. So these are just some isotopes with half-lives between 5 days and 1,000 years that have some alpha decay branch. So in principle, you could also produce some of those sources either at reactors or, for example, at an ISOLD facility. For example, here, actiniums can really well be produced at ISOLD. So you can also just produce your source online and then put it in an envelope and ship it to your local university.
Wait.
Sorry? Yeah. Perhaps a little bit more than putting it in an envelope. Yeah. Yeah. So now we have these ions in our high pressure volume. Now we want to extract them, and there we want to put them in a simple quadruple ion trap. Then we can store them. Now we can do the chemical reaction inside our ion trap. And here we can piggyback on work that has been done by our friends in chemistry. And there have been lots of work on really studying ion chemistry between various ions and, for example, here SF6, CF4. And you see here an example. So these are different elements that were studied, and the color coding tell you that if you do a reaction of such an ion with SF6, you see which ions are very likely to actually produce you in green would be, for example, here barium. You get barium fluoride and tells you where the ion stays. And for some of them, for example, here in blue, you basically you get a reaction, but the erbium, for example, much rather gets neutral and you produce SF5, which is, so yes, you have produced erbium fluoride, but it's neutral. So depending on what your goal is, that may be a useful reaction, or for us working with ion traps, which need to touch particle, these ions are lost for us. In terms of actinides, however, there's very little done to study these chemical reactions of actinides. There are two exemptions, and these are basically thorium and uranium, which are very well studied. Also in terms of nuclear fuel cycle, people are really interested in studying reactions of uranium and thorium fluoride for these ones. And here's a nice example where people now study the reaction of uranium ions with SF6, and they did this at different energies. You can see really the kinetic energy between the uranium ion hitting the SF6 particle changes. You see how different reaction channels actually become more or less likely. In terms of radium, there have been the work, of course, at ISOLD, which was done with neutral radium and CF4. And there has been some work by UC Santa Barbara, who really you produced radium OH plus and radium OHC3 plus by storing radium inside the ion trap for very long periods of time. And in principle, the same group has now also just a couple of weeks ago, I think, or was it last month, published a new paper where they have a new thorium source, a new radium source, which is now housed in a small volume, which is basically a solid kind of structure. And then also you get thorium decays. In here, you produce radium, and then you get a neutral particle beam, which they then can capture reionize inside their trap. So this works really well. However, the problem is that the efficiency of such a setup is very small, and at max, they only ended up with about sort of half a radium per minute, which for some applications may be a bit too low in terms of intensity. So what we are proposing is now to use established stopping cell technology from these high energy facilities. So build a stopping cell, a small one, 10 by 10 centimeters, put thorium inside, This should typically work with about 20% efficiency. So if you put in a megabecquerel or a kilobecquerel thorium, you should roughly get 20% of those radiums out. Then we want to have a first quadrupole mass filter to suppress the unwanted molecules, the unwanted species, because your decay chain will not stop at radium. It will continue to go down. So if you want to produce or want to study chemical reactions in control matters, you want to have a first selection. Then we want to have a reaction cell, which would be our second quadrupole. So this one will then be filled with CF4 or SF6, where we can do some more chemical reactions. And then we want to have another quadrupole mass filter to filter out the unwanted species, or in the future also have a high-resolution time-of-flight mass spectrometer to really identify even different isobaric contamination. And then we could neutralize, cool these ions, these neutral ones, and then perhaps do a spin precession experiment. But this is sort of much further down the way. And the work we are doing is really more focusing on the production of radioactive molecules via these initial ion trapping steps. Then we can use this to study some of the chemical properties of those actinide molecules. So in that sense, with the such a setup, we can now build a tabletop experiment roughly the size of a meter to do decentralized experiments at low background environments, and you really have rather stable operation for weeks or months for your experiments. And we think this is a really good path forward if one wants to study radioactive molecules. So we built such a setup. So here's the technical drawing. So this here would be our small stopping cell. It's an aluminum chamber about 10 centimeter in length. This will house our thorium source. The source is not yet installed, but we tested the cell with stable ions first, mainly because I run this as an undergrad experiment, and somehow our radiation safety was not too happy if I have undergrads work with an open thorium source, because in principle the thorium just loosely sits on the surface. So if you go over the surface and then lick your finger, you have absorbed all our thorium. So here's now a picture of the cell. So this is our small stopping cell. We have tested this with cesium and argon ions in the last couple months. And now also since beginning of the year, we now commissioned a quadrupole system. So this is our sort of triple quadrupole system, where we have a first quadrupole mass filter, a chemical reaction cell that is differentially pumped, and a second quadrupole mass filter to do identification. And then actually, as of last week, we have done some first chemical reactions with our setup. Here we went with argon plus ions, which are very well known to react with SF6 gas. And that's a very nice benchmark for our setup. It's all stable, non-radioactive. So I could really have this as a student experiment. And now you see here, if we now add different amounts of SF6 into our chamber, you see how this argon peak goes down and the additional peaks appearing in our mass spectra. And if we do this more systematically, you see that the argon intensity actually drops linear, which is a good sign for a first order chemical reaction. But at the same time, we then see how different ions such as argon fluoride, SF3, SF5 actually starting to be produced. However, one of the problems we have with our setup now is that our mass resolution here with our simple quadrupole isn't good enough. So actually we cannot separate if we actually produce argon fluoride, or which may be more likely actually being argon fluoride with an hydrogen attached, so that we can figure out with our current setup. So that's where we need the higher mass resolution to actually see what molecules we have actually produced. But then in the next weeks, hopefully, we have our thorium source in Edinburgh since December or something like this. So we plan to install this later this year and then look at first reactions of radium ions, 2 to 4 radium ions with SF6. So hopefully we can then really study the chemical reactions. So in the meantime, at GSI, we have a established stopping cell and mass spectrometry device sitting that typically gets used for online experiments. But in the week before Christmas last year, nobody wanted to run beams at GSI, and the facility was in shutdown. So we could actually use the stopping cell and the multi-reflection time-of-flight mass spectrometer at GSI to actually study reactions with radium. So you see, this is a picture of the device. So this is much larger than a meter. The stopping cell here is about a cubic meter in volume. Then there's some quadrupole transport beam line and a time of flight mass spectrometer that bends down here. The cell at GSI is actually a cryogenic cell. So it operates at 70 Kelvin, which also makes some molecules more likely compared to others. So traditionally, we use the cell to measure radioactive isotopes to high precision mass measurements. Remember, at the in-flight scheme, we typically produce them at about a GeV per nucleon. We filter them with this fragment separator and then send a pure beam into the stopping cell. The ions stop in here, they get extracted. We transport them through our radio frequency quadrupole beam line and then send them in this time of flight mass spectrometer here, where we extend the flight path by sending ions between the electrostatic ion mirrors to get a really large flight path in a compact system to get high separation between different species. And actually for, let's say, almost a decade, with these type of experiments, we have always fought to get rid of molecules. Because in these environments, for example, our actinium ion here, when they stop, ions typically take about 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 9 collisions until they actually get extracted. So if your purity in your helium gas is on the ppb level, you just collide once with a partner species that has a high collision cross-section, and suddenly your ion of interest may charge exchange, and you actually don't get them out anymore. And we have seen many molecules here, for example, actinium OH2+ was extracted from our cell. And we actually fought for a week to actually break up actinium OH2+ into actinium in order to do mass measurements on this one. So we're really happy when we learned that radioactive molecules could actually be a blessing and not just a curse as we had sort of seen them in the past. In our setup, we typically have a thorium source installed, because for all the commissioning work we do with a 228 thorium source. That means radium-224 is one of our standard ions that we have available on a weekly basis to actually test our complete ion trap and mass spectrometry setup. So we now use this to really test these chemical reactions with radium. And remember that the thorium decays into radium, decays into radon, decays into polonium, decays into lead. And then there are some beta decay branches, which then also, again, decay into lead-208 and thallium-208. So in principle, if our precursor ion does an alpha decay, the energy is sufficient to kick it into the gas, and then we can see it. If it does a beta decay, they just stick on the surface. The van der Waals forces are too strong, and with the beta decay, they don't come out. And we then use our first quadrupole here as a mass filter. We could show that roughly from our radium, about 80-90% are extracted as a 2+ ion, where about 10% actually come as a 1+ ion, and that's will depend on which element you're looking at, but at least it's roughly the same for radium and for polonium and lead, whereas radon typically purely gets extracted as a 1+ ion. And this really depend on the ionization potential of our element of interest and helium. So we could then use the second region here to actually add trace gases of SF6. And then in order to not change the pressure, we kept the pressure fixed. We just changed the storage time inside our ion trap. So in that sense, if we store ions twice as long, they have twice as many collisions with SF6. So we can sort of controllably change how many collisions ions actually do. And then we can use this to actually measure the chemical reaction cross-section. So you see now here the intensity of radium-2+ without SF6 added. You see up to about 100 milliseconds storage time, we see no effects. And then at some point, we actually do some unwanted reactions of our radium, so then it goes down. Probably we pick up an OH and neutralize at that point. However, if we now add SF6 to our ion trap setup, you can see that actually then the radium intensity actually drops very rapidly over here until we have here converted all radium ions into they're all gone. If we now tune the mass spectrometer into a different isotope, different element region, we can see at the same time, if we keep storing longer here, the radium fluoride ions actually come up. And interestingly, the intensity before and after is almost identical. So it suggests that we actually convert almost 100% of our radium 2+ into radium fluoride. And at the same time, we also see that actually SF5+ is actually appearing in the spectra. So it seems that the most likely reactant is actually the radium-2+ reacts with SF6 and produces radium fluoride singly charged and SF5 also singly charged. And in principle, if we now do this reaction now at different pressures and we know the concentration of SF6 in our setup, we can actually work out the chemical reaction constant. Sadly, we learned that our vacuum gauges don't like SF6 gas. And after 3 days running with SF6, already two of our vacuum gauges were broken. So we don't really know the pressure of SF6 that we have in our setup. We can just say if we increase the flow by a factor of 2, you see going from the black curve to the red curve, you see the reaction happens roughly then around twice as fast. But turning this into an absolute collision cross-section sadly did not work due to not knowing the real number of SF6 particles in our setup. However, we have this convenient setup with this high-resolution mass spectrometer here at the end. And now we could actually have a look at reactions and compare 1+ versus 2+ chemical reactions. So by setting our first quadrupole now to only transmit 1+ ions, and this would be the black lines over here, we see we extract radon as a singly charged ions, we extract lead to 212 and lead 208 from our setup, and we also see the presence of SF6. We actually see there's a small peak of radium fluoride, which is consistent with our extraction rate of producing radium as a singly charged ion. So if we now turn our mass filter to only allow 2+ ions into the region of interest, so set this guy to only transport 2+ species, then actually see how the lead ions, so the lead 2+ actually goes away, and now we see a much higher radium fluoride peak, which is just consistent with we produce much more radium 2+ ions, so there's more that can produce radium fluoride later on. But at the same time, we now see other species that are not expected to actually chemically react. We see lead 208 fluoride positive produced, lead 212 fluoride singly, so lead F1 basically being produced. But we see that those reactions actually only happen if we use 2+ lead ions, not with 1+ lead ions. And actually interesting is also that if you look very careful, where is it here? You see this one, this red peak here, you see actually polonium fluoride. So for the first time, we could actually produce polonium fluoride. We do not know if this is actually interesting for an EDM experiment, but chemically this is interesting because nothing is known about the chemistry of polonium. So now we have some estimates about this. And if we compare this to some rough enthalpy, or in physics you would call it Q value calculations about these reactions, so this somewhat matches. So we would expect the reaction of radium 2+ with SF6 should be exothermic with about 3 MeV, with 1+ should be exothermic with 2 MeV, whereas for lead+, only the 2+ reactant is actually exothermic, whereas the 1+ reactant is actually endothermic. So that means the 1+ should actually not react with SF6 to form lead fluoride. And this is sort of matches from these very rough estimates, matches what we see in our measurements. So now we can study these molecules. And one thing I want to take a step back is, how does these MRTOF mass spectrometers actually work? So these are electrostatic time-of-flight mass spectrometers. They work by, you take an ion assemble, you prepare them as a very narrow ion bunch, you just let them fly. And then the kinetic energy is the same for all ions. That means their velocity only depends on their mass value. Meaning if you allow ions to fly over very long periods of time, even the distance between two isotopes that have same nucleon numbers, but different binding energy will actually appear as different blobs in our spectra. And then we can do high precision mass measurements. So in that sense, ions are electrostatically reflected between two electrostatic mirrors. And in such a compact setup, we can get pass lengths of a kilometer or two or something like this. And one can actually show that the transmission losses in a really well-tuned mass spectrometer only occur not due to ion optics, but they only occur via collisions with neutral gas particles inside our vacuum chamber. So it means, because we have a closed ion trap next to this mass spectrometer, it's differentially pumped. We have a pressure of, let's say, 10⁻⁷ millibar or so inside our spectrometer. And this is mainly helium gas from our ion traps. So that means over a kilometer of pass length, you actually elastically collide with the helium particle, and then you get scattered away out of the acceptance of our spectrometer. And you can see this here. This is a measurement from the Titan spectrometer in Canada, where you see the transmission as a function of number of turns for different gas pressures. And you can fit this with exponential decay curves. From this, you can work back the mean free pass. And if you know the number density or the pressure inside your time of light analyzer, you can actually work back to the ion neutral collision cross section. So the real hard sphere sort of collision cross section. And we did this here, for example. Sorry, this picture is a little bit small. I couldn't find the original figure anymore. But you see here, these are now the collision cross section measured via the decay in terms of transmission inside our spectrometer. And we can relate this over a wide pressure range to the expected, here in this case, potassium with helium collision cross-section. So that means if we take a random sample of ions, store them into our MR-TOF, we have it well-tuned, we can just monitor the decay, and from the decay curve, we can work back what the collision cross-section of our ion of interest is. This is nothing new. In principle, this is all done in analytical mass spectrometry. This is how an ion mobility mass spectrometer works. They just don't do this at 10 minus 6 millibar. They do this at, let's say, 100 millibar or something like this. And with this one, you can really see, for example, different collisional cross sections for different molecules, which then will depend on the shape or the size, in that sense, of your molecule of interest. So now we did this in our experiment with radium fluoride, lead fluoride, and we also had lead OH in our spectra. We can see how these different isotopes, the decay over 200 turns, which roughly corresponds to about 300 to 350 meters of pass lengths now, is different for the different isotopes. You see here radium decays with about 150 turns on average, lead with about 170, lead OH with about 130 turns. So that means we can relate this to the size of these nucleus, and actually compare this to the collision cross-section with cesium. So you also repeated such a scan with cesium, and you can see that radium fluoride probably has about a 20-25% larger collision cross-sections compared to lead, compared to cesium, whereas the lead fluoride here is actually comparable, where and then lead OH and polonium fluoride are about 20 to 30% larger compared to cesium. And now we're now working on really what does it mean in terms of size of the molecule for these hard sphere collision cross sections. So therefore I hope I showed you a new method how we can produce radioactive molecules without using an accelerator. We tested this method at the FS ion catcher at GSI. On peak, we now reached about 10 radium fluoride ions per second of the highest intensity we got. Some of the limiting factors were the acceptance of our ion traps and the efficiency of our cell, but we think we can actually improve this, and intensities of about 10 to the 4 should probably be possible, perhaps 10 to the 5, depending on radiation safety considerations. And that can really then used to, first of all, study chemical properties of these radioactive molecules, but can also be a suitable source for future EDM experiments using radium fluoride, using other actinide-containing molecules. In our experiment, we studied the chemical reactions of radium fluoride and other and polonium fluoride. But in principle, the scheme can be expanded to anything that you can produce as a long-lived source. And typically, I would say if the half-life is about 10 to 15 days, it may be a suitable candidate. If the half-life gets much longer than 1,000 years, then you actually need to start with quite a high amount of material to actually produce a reasonable amount of material. And here in our measurement, we use this to measure the elastic collision cross-sections of different species with helium. And then over the next month or so, we want to commission our dedicated Rafiki instrument in Edinburgh. As I mentioned, we have our thorium source now available, and hopefully in the next couple of months or so, we will install this and then really want to carefully look at chemical reactions of radium with different gases. So if you have an idea for a cool molecule that's maybe interesting for an EDM experiment, I'm happy to have a chat and see if we can perhaps produce something, or perhaps at least study if we can produce this. And therefore, thank you all for listening, and thank you to my collaborators and the FRS Ion Catcher and Rafiki collaboration. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Yes,
thank you very much. And this is really both amazing and very exciting. Really. How do you imagine the utilization, optional utilization after your instrument that you said it's not the future, but how do you, so what kinetic energies can you extract the ions with after your setup, and what kind of utilization instrument will be used? The typical target chain cells don't do too well with very slow projectile ions. You need some kinetic energy at least to work well, otherwise you just
Okay, thanks for the question. So there I have no good experience, right? I come from mass spectrometry, nuclear physics, ion trapping. So I know ion traps and I know how to work with ions. Once things are neutral, I typically discard them because then I can no longer use my electric fields to control them. So this is where we will look for collaborators to work on such directions. In principle, at the moment, our ions are flying with energies of about an eV or so after the stopping cell. But in principle, there's nothing that would prevent us from just floating our stopping cell on a platform to then have ions be reaccelerated to, let's say, 10 or 30 keV or something like this. Of course, for us in Edinburgh, having this as a student experiment is always nice when there's no open high voltage and your vacuum chambers on ground is always a really nice feature for an experiment. I'm trying to remember this. So we did some intensity measurements back during my PhD, and I think about 10 to the 4 relativistic ions was roughly the limit. But the difference is when you stop a relativistic uranium ion in there, it reduces 10 to the 9 helium electron pair. So you basically light up your complete stopping cell. Now from the alpha decay, you don't stop 5 MeV in your cell, you stop 100 keV or 60 keV. So it should be more forgiving for the lower intensities. I would say probably, 10 to the 4 should definitely work, 10 to the 5 should probably also work. One would probably get diminishing returns if one goes much above 10 to the 5. So I guess so, between 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 would be my estimate for now.
Do you know anything about the internal state of the molecule? So rotational, vibrational, they're all the same molecule, but so quite different.
So we don't know too much about this. However, when ions are... So the stopping cell here is at 60 Kelvin. And so that means the helium gas, where they get stopped, thermalized, slowed down, and then extracted, is at 60 Kelvin. Mm-hmm. So in principle, we probably have, when they come out, they're probably around 60 Kelvin, right? Think about, they do 10 to the 6, 10 to the 9 collisions with cold helium gas. I guess that should be sufficient to cool them. However, then they also do another 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 collision inside our quadruple beamline, which is at room temperature. That probably heats them back up to room temperature, would be my guess.
Maybe let's go back to the slide where you describe the different reaction channels and whether they're exothermic or endothermic.
This one?
Yeah. So you have a reaction pathway with single charge radium into directly neutral hydrochloric gas. But this is.
You mean the lower one?
Yeah,
but this was just analytically, this was not observed. This was just for us doing the mass. So the upper one would be 2 plus radium with SF6, producing radium fluoride ion.
Yeah.
And for the lower one would be radium ion with SF6, producing neutral radium fluoride and a positively charged SF5. But you see, this one is actually an endothermic. So this one would actually need quite some energy to do.
So in your current arrangement of the reaction, do you have optical access? Because it might be that maybe SF6 is not the correct reacting agent for this pathway, but there is a reacting agent that will give you directly ready for a neutron. And you send the laser in, you put the CCD camera, you see it directly. So this gives you both an analytical tool for the neutral product, but also basically an already stopped neutral beam that you want to capture in the model.
That's a very interesting idea. In our setup at GSI, we have no access. There's just everything is covered with stuff. But in our setup in Edinburgh, we could probably arrange for having an optical access, just having a glass window there that you can see this. It's a little bit more tricky because our reaction cell is encapsulated. So one would need to then also make a window into our encapsulation, because we don't want SF6 gas to sort of freely dilute our complete chamber, as what we did at GSI, right? We have learned that our vacuum gauges die within 3 days of operation. So we want to do this slightly different. We want to actually encapsulate the region where we only add the SF6 just to sort of prevent this from reaching other places.
So how do you do that here? Is it just in vacuum? Do you have an extra container with that?
So in Edinburgh, yes, we basically have an in-vacuum container that has 2 and 5 millimeter apertures on both sides, and then it's just differentially pumped. At GSI, we just added SF6 into the complete vacuum chamber. and allowed this to react. The other thing that we can do in Edinburgh is we can actually, let me see, perhaps this may be the better figure. So in Edinburgh, we can basically bias our complete reaction cell. So actually we can reaccelerate ions into this chemical reaction region. At GSI, we can only trap them and store them. And this is great because we can store them for a half a second. So we win sort of massive order in sensitivity and don't need to go to high pressures. But therefore, you basically only measure chemical reactions at thermal energies because you have you store them, so they are room temperature. Whereas in Edinburgh, we can now make this this cell lower and then just reaccelerate them in here with, let's say, 10, 20, 20 eV. And then we should probably also be able to trigger reactions that are sort of energetically not beneficial. Okay. Yeah.
You actually, I mean, you need three bodies. The third body to form a molecule like this in life. So, you know, normal, I mean, you have to conserve momentum in it, right?
Yeah.
Normally, when you have something like this happen, there's a free body, third body involved to do that. That's not, I mean, where he just goes through there and eventually picks up. Or
yeah, this is basically how we do it. And there are some people who do these reactions to actually add some extra amount of helium that you have some extra. I don't know, cooling, or but have a certain species available that does not react, but just is there as a collision partner.
And
the molecules or the
yeah.
So the radium fluoride, we tried to. So this was one of the ideas we had at GSI was to produce it and then measure how easy it breaks up. So our goal was then we have this region up here again filled with 10 minus 2 millibar helium gas. So actually we then reaccelerated them between the molecular formalin region and the sort of transport region, but we could only accelerate them to 30 eV. And at least the 30 eV in the lab frame, which corresponds to three or four eV in the center of mass frame, we did not break it up. So we know the bond energy of radium fluoride must be at least more than three. So our hope was to see reaccelerate them until it starts to break up through collision-induced dissociation, but we just didn't see this happening. So that's why we don't have a value for this.
Can these guys calculate?
You pointing at here?
Yeah, we did it,
but I don't remember the number of them. Does anyone know?
I think it was five or six.
But it's several units, so it's very stable thing. Yeah. It's roughly the same bond strength as in CF4. Right? So that was the reason why we proposed to use CF4 together with radium ion to produce radium fluoride. So it's a very strong bond. What about 5 eV?
It's in this small class where the IP is lower than the higher than the such a good
one. So we tried to measure this. We were hoping to see this, but just we had 30 volt power supplies. We just couldn't do more kinetic energy, so we didn't see it. It was inconclusive.
Great stuff.
Any other question?
That's one question to you. So you mentioned the 10 ions per second. Mm-hmm. Can you accumulate?
Yes. So basically, right, this is what we did over here, right? So this is an accumulation measurement in that sense. But we could also just use a second trap further down and just accumulate there and then send you a stronger bunch.
Yeah.
Of course, at the moment when you start to accumulate again, you start also to resample the different environment in your accumulation zone. So if the accumulation zone now may contain some hydrogen, some water vapor, just from residual gas, you may perhaps trigger other reactions. But
have to check for some trace molecules, like for example, SF6 plus or a lead F2 plus, which could lead to some hints on what the mechanism behind all of the gas-based reactions could be.
So we saw this after the experiment. Sadly, our mass spectrometer was never set to see something heavier than radium fluoride. So we basically kept the mass spectrum around mass 245. So we don't know if this sort of drop in, for example, radium fluoride actually is now, at least you see this at the low pressure SF6, you see this goes up and stays up. Whereas if we add more SF6 to the cell, you see it actually drops down. So that we just don't know what happens because we couldn't see radium F2. Our spectrometer was not set up for this. So we don't really know why there was actually then another reaction happening with radium fluoride ions that perhaps they now charge exchange with water or with SF6 again and produce radium F2, but neutral also. Certainly we can't see this, yeah. But it's one of the things we only realized when I did the analysis after the experiment. So it would have been very useful to see this over the earlier.
Then I think Moritz again. And then I think that's the closing of the session. And everybody who has signed up or those who haven't can join at 7 o'clock tonight at the pizzeria. I can't pronounce that.
But meanwhile, this is our opportunity to talk over the posters. So,
I tried to pronounce it and we have a purpose.
Great, plus a thing.
Yes, good thing is very important.
All parts of the
team are there. Think about it.